And there was also taken advantage of a bit of some fixed rates through some non-bank lenders.
Yep.
So that 3% buffer that I talked about has really only been it's only applicable for deposit-taking institutions. So some of them, especially in the current environment where rates are expected to decrease, not increase, they are choosing to take a different approach as far as their buffers are concerned. And there's one in particular that I've used had a 5-year fixed rate, which maybe you normally might not necessarily recommend, but there are ways around this, which I can talk through if you want to, Bushy. But on that 5-year fixed rate, they don't have any buffer. So if you take their 5-year fixed rate, which is currently pretty much in line with variable rates,
yep,
there's no buffer. So instead of having to afford the loan at 9%, you're basically affording the loan at 6%. And that gives you a significant amount of additional borrowing capacity.
Welcome to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel, the leading weekly show to help you unlock your full self, health and wealth potential. I'm your host, Bushy Martin, and each week I go deep with the best investors, experts, leaders and founders to find out what it takes to break free from the grind, discover freedom and live by design. Subscribe now and join me and get invested in the life you really want. Let's get started.
Hi, Freedom Fighters. How important do you think your financing and loans are to your property success? Are you struggling to borrow enough to secure your next property or refinance your home loan? And you just don't know what you can do about it or what your options are? And how can you maximise your borrowing capacity and purchasing price power while minimising your costs as well as your risks? If any or all of these questions are of interest to you, then you've landed in the right place because they're all very closely related. Sadly for many, home loan lending or property investment borrowings are assumed to be just a means to an end because all banks are the same and it's just about getting the lowest rate loan because that's all the banks and a lot of brokers bang on about, right? Wrongity, wrong, wrong, wrong. As we constantly reiterate, property is a game of finance and an elite team sport. Getting the right borrowing strategy and structure and the resulting loan to suit your specific needs will make or break your capacity, your cost, and your risk, as well as your stress levels. So to optimise all this, you need to be working with a savvy mortgage broker who has the accumulated wealth of wisdom, experience, and expertise to craft the best financing solution to suit your specific needs and goals. Because when it comes to loans, the devil's in the detail, and the experience required to fully understand the ins and outs of over 40 different banks and lenders' policies and processes, along with getting your head around over 2,000 different loan products, takes years to master. And in this regard, the revolving door of bank staff and Johnny-come-lately brokers who might have been spray painters or hairdressers yesterday and brokers today is just not going to cut it if you're really serious about setting yourself up financially and achieving sustainable success in property. Let me give you a couple of quick examples to whet your appetite. As I've mentioned before, there's over a 55% variation across the banks in terms of how much they'll let you borrow. In very simple terms, this means that one bank may allow you to purchase a property of about 500 grand, while one of the others can allow you to secure a $775,000 property based on exactly the same financial position. And this initial $275,000 difference has the potential to add an extra $790,000 to your equity in 20 years' time, assuming that both value properties grow at the same rate. Now, similarly, when it comes to rate versus cost, a low-rate loan often ends up being much more expensive long-term because when you add in ingoing, ongoing, and outgoing fees, along with the impacts of offset accounts and other debt reduction features, a higher-rate loan can often end up being lower cost to the tune of tens of thousands and sometimes even hundreds of thousands of dollars. So focus on true cost, not initial rate, as low rate loans often end up becoming what I call shagulator loans that end up costing you a lot more over time. Now, one of the other critical elements to consider when getting a loan to buy property is your risk. As we're going to discuss in more detail with our special guests shortly, most banks are more concerned about minimizing their risk than yours. So what you may not know is that you're at risk of losing your house if all of your properties and loans are cross-securitized with the one bank. A serious risk that's rarely discussed that may also have the flow-on effects of reducing your capacity and your flexibility to do what you want with the properties, but more on this later. So from our perspective, your finance and lending strategy and structure is mission critical to your property success. And working with an experienced and savvy mortgage broker right from the get-go, before you even start looking at properties, is absolutely essential. So how do you structure the best loan solution for you? And how can you select and separate a great broker from the average low-rate loan broker or bank? Well, this is where today's returning guest, Laurie Moore, comes to your rescue. Because this week, we're going to help you answer all of these questions as we continue with part two of our great conversation with Laurie, who I'm proud to say is one of Knighow's award-winning senior finance broker partners, or finance architects as we keep calling ourselves. And in my humble opinion, he's an expert at designing the best loan structure, strategy and solution to suit you. Now, last week, we dug into Laurie's own personal journey. And this week, we dive into the nitty-gritties of property lending and finance broking so that we can help you to get a much better understanding of what's important to you when it comes to financing your next property purchase or refinancing to reduce your costs. As in the current lending environment, it's never been more important to get your finance and your loans right. So let's dive back in to our great conversation and let's get invested again, Laurie.
Hello, Bushy. Thanks for having me back again, mate.
Right, mate. I really enjoyed our part one last week, and now we're going to sort of dig deep into subjects that are near and dear to both of our hearts. And like where I always like to start with it, this sort of an exercise, mate, is to get you to run through what you think are some of the biggest mistakes that many make around borrowing money to buy property.
Well, the biggest mistake people make is going directly to their bank, right? So it's the bank's got their own interests at heart, so going directly to them is putting money in their pocket, I guess. I guess you go there if you're happy to pay a higher interest rates or higher loan costs, to talk about it from that perspective. You've got money to burn, I guess, and you don't really care about the consequences, then go directly to a bank. And if not, then if you've got the time and the energy and the expertise, compare 40 plus lenders and 2,000 plus loan products, then I can assure you it's a full-time job, because I do it all the time. So don't try and take it on yourself. So that's probably one of the biggest mistakes, either going to the bank or trying to do it all yourself. The other's sort of looking at lowest rate versus lowest cost. So it's not always the case that the lowest interest rate is the best loan. There's other aspects associated with that, such as the fees and charges and offset accounts that can help save you money over time, and help you save your tax over time too, if it's an investment property as well. So getting that done properly. There's also the other aspects around capacity. Going to your own bank is going to just give you one answer in terms of capacity. Looking across a broad range of banks and lenders is going to give you a completely different sphere of what is actually possible. Other lenders are prepared to take on more risk than others and have different policies. There's so many different variables, and every person's situation is unique. And you've got to try and match that with the right lender to get the best possible outcome in terms of price and in terms of capacity. So I think, it's a mistake not to be able to have someone on your team to be able to do that for you. We talk about cross-securitization. Well, that's probably a bit of an industry term, isn't it? But it just means tying up all your properties with your loans, so that once you want to sell a property or transact on one of your properties, you find you can't do that without a lot of unnecessary administration, and but you can't do it at all because the bank says you can't, because everything's tied up together. So it's really important to not make that mistake and make sure that the loans are all standalone against properties, so that you can still transact on those properties independently. Rainy day reserves, I guess, people probably don't often consider that. I probably would be guilty of that in the past as well, where don't set enough money aside to ride out the highs and lows of being a property owner. Having all loans with one bank is a bit risky. Sometimes it works okay, but most of the time it's not the case. And potentially it could be as bad as co-securing your properties.
Yeah.
Because the bank can, if you've got them all with one bank, they can still treat them. In some cases, it's rare, but it does happen, right? Where they can treat it as if it is, even if it's not co-secured. Yeah. And I think another thing I've seen people do quite a bit who might have bought their first investment properties when they haven't had the knowledge around this is they might have paid down their home loan a bit. And they think, oh, we've got some equity, we've got some money in redraw. Let's go and take this money out of redraw, and that can be a deposit on our first investment property. But that's a mistake because that money's not tax deductible, right? So the money's coming out of an owner occupied home loan. It's difficult to make it tax deductible. So you don't want to be doing that. You need to be setting up a separate facility for investment purposes that can be used easily explained to the tax man at the time when you're coming to make your tax deductions.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's sort of, like I said, the other thing is staying with the bank forever and not refinancing, negotiating with them regularly. And I've seen some unbelievable, I did this with a family member recently and they were just astounded. We couldn't really refinance them, but they hadn't spoken to their lender for about 5 years, and they were 2% higher or almost on a standard variable rate, which pretty much no one's on, or so I thought. And they were paying 2% more than what they should have. So it was just a quick phone call in, and rate gets dropped, and a much better result. So there's a fair bit of that, and just staying too loyal to one bank for too long is going to cost you money.
Yeah, and I think that's a big one, actually, because the sleepers out there, Laurie, are the ones that concern me. It's like, and I think that the perceived headache and hassle of, oh, God, I've got to go get all this paperwork and go through the rigmarole and I already can't scratch myself because I'm flat out work, and then after hours of looking after the kids and all of that stuff that goes with that is a bit of a hurdle that gets in the way. But the amount of money that people are costing themselves by sticking with the bank, and on similar lines to that too, Laurie, I'd like your thoughts on this as well. But what a lot of people I don't think realise is that lending policies are changing almost by the day and the week. So just because a bank says no now doesn't mean that you shouldn't be revisiting it on a regular basis, because things are changing constantly, and it's not a set in stone exercise that if no one can say no, say yes now, that doesn't mean it's locked away forever. Because it's a constantly changing feast, and banks are businesses like everyone else, and therefore are often very competitive, and things at times are tough, they'll find ways of being able to borrow money because it's a big part of their income streams. I think that regular revisiting, whether you're refinancing or looking at it, is something that if people aren't doing, they're potentially costing themselves a lot of money. And we're talking not just biscuits, we're talking thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars over the long term if they're not on top of that. So, I guess you're covering a lot of stuff there. Without going into infinite detail, given those mistakes, what are some of the best ways to overcome them, you think?
Well, I guess it probably is just the opposite of what I said, really, isn't it? It's using a broker. 70% of loans now, I think, are written by or mortgage brokers. So people are voting with their feet as far as that is concerned.
Yeah.
Well, we've got access to 40 lenders. We've got you multiply that across the number of products, and there's thousands of loan solutions that can help to maximize your capacity or minimizing cost of risk, I guess. So just making sure that the structure is right, because the structure is going to be the key to making sure that you're paying the lowest amount as possible, so it's costing you as little as possible, and that you're not opening yourself up to risk, I guess. And then also you're in the most tax advantageous position, in conjunction with talking with your accountant about that, of course, but that's certainly, we have lots of experience around that, so making sure that that's the case. I guess that standalone loan structure as well. We talked about cross-securitization, making sure that we stick with standalone securities and minimise risk across that way.
Yeah, let's dive into that one a little bit, because that's one of the most common ones that I see people not getting their heads around. And again, it's very difficult for us to explain that verbally. But and add to this if you can, Laurie, but very simply, ideally, if you're going to the extreme of risk protection and maximizing your capacity, each property would have its own separate loan without any ties to any other property or any other loan.
Yep.
And in some instances where it's appropriate, having each property have a different lender attached as well. So there's not one lender who potentially has got control over the whole portfolio. As you said a couple of times, you've got to look at that on its merits and weigh the pros and cons there. But certainly that standalone structure then allows people to buy and sell properties at their will, not at the bank's control, because as we all know, if a bank, if it's cross-securitized and a bank does, and you want to trigger a change, either sell or buy a property, then the bank will automatically revalue everything. And if bank value is being conservative at the time or the market's down and suddenly you don't have the equity to do what you want to do, then suddenly you're locked out. Whereas going standalone, you decide what to do with the properties and what you're going to do with the loan. So it's putting more control back in the hands of the property owner and the investor. Any other thoughts around that one?
Yeah, I think that standalone structure, I mean, you've summed that up pretty well, mate. The standalone structure is something that we will always try to do. Like a number of times I've had people come to me where the broker's been pretty lazy and just gone all the loans with one bank and everything's co-secured across multiple properties, and it's the first thing you try to do is to unwind that for them and put them in a better position to be able to make decisions moving forward. Because it might not be that you want to sell a property now, but at some point that's going to happen, whether that's from personal reasons or for investment reasons or a myriad of reasons that could come up. So you want to make sure that your loan portfolio is best structured to enable you to act as quickly as possible rather than have to go through a whole set of hoops in order to achieve what you want. So yeah, I think that's a key. Look, the other things that we probably need to talk about is making sure you've got those rainy day reserves as well. If you're investing in property, just making sure that there's 6 months worth of costs set aside, 6 months worth of income potentially. It doesn't necessarily have to be savings. You can set that up as an equity loan against one of your properties. It's an equity loan that has a buffer in it of $30,000 or so, $30,000 or $40,000, depending on the size of the portfolio.
And that's the important thing to emphasize on that one, because people are going, oh, what do you mean I have to take another $30,000 extra on the loan? The key part here is that if we've set it up the right way, as we do, as an interest-only loan, then if they're not using the money, it's not costing them anything. So all this is doing is building some fat into the exercise, so that if something does go wrong, I lose a job or something happens to the property or the tenant does a runner or whatnot, then they've got the low-cost funds to fall back on without costing them anything. Yeah. Interim. So I'd say, as you say, building in that contingency and that risk protection to cover unforeseen events that they're not going to put them in financial stress if they have to put in their hand in their savings or start spending salary to make that happen.
Yeah, that's right. So you're not having to sacrifice your lifestyle, basically.
Yeah.
So the lifestyle continues on if there's a period of non-tenancy or unexpected cost, you've got ready access to funds that you can draw on. That is not costing you anything whilst it's there, because it's sitting in an offset account, and you're paying no interest on it effectively. So I think that's the other thing. I mean, there's probably a few other things in there, Bushy, but mostly is just making. We talked about this before, but having those regular home loan health checks as well, and just making sure that preferably every 18 months, but at the most every 2 years, that there's a bit of a review going on of the portfolio and how it sits, and whether it should stay the way it is. Well, the start of that really is to negotiate directly with the lenders that the loans are with, and we can have a great variance in results with different lenders, and determined by their appetite and their pressures on their own profits and margins at the time. So in some cases they're happy to drop the pants, if that's allowed to be said on this podcast.
Yep, absolutely.
And I've got some amazing results for people, and I talked about one of those before, but it's just incredible, really. There was a period where there was this whole cashback process going through for people to refinance, where lenders were offering up to $4,000, really, to win your business. So offer you a lower rate and then also offer you a cashback. But if you played your cards right, you could actually take advantage of that from what the banks were offering and put the money in your pocket. And I did that for a number of people where I successfully negotiated rates, lower rates, and even if people weren't going to leave the bank or couldn't leave because of borrowing capacity concerns or something like that, the bank has no idea around that. So it's really just playing that game a little bit, getting access to lower interest rates, potentially getting a cash back for those clients when they would not otherwise have got one. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on which way you look at it, most of those cashbacks don't exist anymore. There's still a couple of lenders with them, and that's probably a good thing because it was distorting the market a little bit, and it got a little bit out of hand. They started at $1,000, they went up to $2,000, they increased to $4,000, and one or two lenders offering $2,000 per property. So if you had five properties and you were refinancing all of them, you'd give you $10,000.
It was. I think you managed to achieve that prep for you, didn't you?
Yeah, did manage to get a couple, mate. It was, as I said, mate, taking the opportunity while it was there because, we could see that it was short term until someone realised, why are we giving away all this money and what impact is it having on our margins and our profits? So we did do that. I mean, there was a time there, I think, where I got one client to refinance to two different banks to get the token advantage of cash back. So they had two different loans, a home loan and an investment loan. We did a refinance with one lender to get their cash back, and we did the investment loan with another lender to get their cash back. So we got two lots of cash back. I think I've done that with a few people, actually, when I think about it. So we have a few of those. But it wasn't just about the cash back. It was the cost of the loan as well. The existing lender wasn't prepared to come to the party. So it made sense to do it because you really got to look at that. In our environment now, there's a high level of compliance. So unless it is in your best interest as the client, then we really can't consider it. It's pretty hard for it not to be in your best interest if you're getting $7,000 or $8,000 in your back pocket through a cashback situation.
But
health checks, mate, as well. I was focusing on there.
Yeah, no, that was I'd love for you to share any. Because I've seen you do some amazing things just through some clever structuring and whatnot over time. Do you want to share some of the other examples of some of the approaches that you've utilised to get better outcomes for borrowers over the years?
Well, there's those retention team tricks that I talked about. I've run retention teams quite a lot and got great results for people. And then there's multiple cashback side that we talked about. What's happened over the last 18 months is that interest rates have gone up significantly. I think everybody that would be listening would be well and truly aware of that. And the impact that that's had is that borrowing capacities have fallen away because rates are higher, and the APRA enforces a buffer on the banks as well. So if interest rates are 6%, then people have to be able to afford it at 3% higher than that, so at 9%. So this has been a bit of an issue over the last 18 months because what you can afford today, you might not be able to afford tomorrow because rates have continued to increase every month. Rates would go up by 0.25% or 0.5%. And if I did a pre-approval for you today, I could never be really sure with some lenders whether you're actually going to be able to fulfill that pre-approval in 3 months' time if rates had gone up by 0.75%, which did happen, right? So that was about choosing the lenders that will honour those pre-approvals. There was a period there when a pre-approval is supposed to be in place for 90 days, so it should be valid for 9 days. It gives you 3 months to go out and find a property and get the loan approved, basically. In some cases, that's not difficult, but in the height of the property boom, that was hard because you were competing with a lot of people to find property. At least you had those 90 days to actually find something. And you were guaranteed that if you did find something, the bank was going to honour the pre-approval. There were a lot of lenders that didn't do that. So I certainly did that for me. It was just about choosing the right banks and making sure that there were no surprises. If someone was potentially going to bid at auction up to $500,000, $600,000, whatever it was, and then find that rates had gone up by too much, so they couldn't afford it anymore. So did quite a bit of that. And there was also taken advantage of some fixed rates through some non-bank lenders.
Yep.
So that 3% buffer that I talked about, it's only applicable for deposit-taking institutions. Yep. because that's what APRA, that's who they look after from a compliance point of view. So some of the non-banks, most of them have chosen to follow that guidance anyway, but they are not forced to. So so some of them, especially in the current environment where rates are expected to decrease, not increase, they are choosing to take a different approach as far as their buffers are concerned. And there's one in particular that I've used, had a 5-year fixed rate, which maybe you normally might not necessarily recommend, but there are ways around this, which I can talk through if you want to, Bushy. But on that 5-year fixed rate, they don't have any buffer. So if you take their 5-year fixed rate, which is currently pretty much in line with variable rates,
yep,
there's no buffer. So instead of having to afford the loan at 9%, you're basically affording the loan at 6%. And that gives you a significant amount of additional borrowing capacity. So I've done that with a few clients, and there's no time frame you have to be in that fixed rate. Really, if you wanted to break that fixed rate, and this is sort of the advice I've given to people along the way, is that, yes, it's a 5-year fixed rate, and sometimes it can be costly to get out of fixed rates if variable rates go down by too much and you're stuck on a higher rate than a variable rate. But at the moment, they're pretty much at parity. So provided we monitor that, and we get you out of that fixed rate, the moment variable rates look like they're going to go down again, you can break the fixed rate, go back on the variable rate, probably cost you a few $100s. You're back on the variable rate down on that, on the downward path as rates come down. So you're really going to be better off from that point of view as well. So I've done that a few times. I've had a few instances where we've got, it's called property share arrangements for siblings, right? Often siblings buy properties together when they're young. Seems like a good idea at the time, but it can, and it is, because it gives them, gets them into property earlier, because they can combine their deposits and their borrowing capacities. But at some point, it gets in the way because they meet a partner and they want to buy a property with the partner, or they no longer want to live together. If they've bought together and are living in the property, and one wants to stay and one doesn't, there are a myriad of issues that can get in the way of this. So, but there are ways around that, because what happens is, as a borrower, you are jointly and severally liable for a debt. So if you take out a loan with your sibling, then all of the cost is associated to you, because if your sister doesn't pay it back, then you have to pay it back. That's certainly how the banks look at it. So that can restrict your borrowing capacity, because they say, well, again, we know you've got a joint loan with your sister, but really we're going to take that all into account, because you if she doesn't pay, you have to pay, right? But there's a couple of lenders there who will look at that differently. And they will say, okay, well, it's an arrangement called property share, and we know that you own 50% of it, but we also know that the other party is earning an income and they're contributing to this. So we will apportion that according to the ownership structure. So if it's a joint tenant and they own 50% each, we'll only take into account 50% of the debt. And so that puts you in a much better position moving forward in terms of what your borrowing capacity might be to do something independent of your sister or sibling or whoever it happens to be. So it's about taking advantage of that sort of thing as well. There is another product that you can use if you come to me at the right time, right? Where we can actually, if a siblings are willing to buy something, we can actually set it up and apportion it properly right from the outset, so you don't have to, utilize that particular part of the apportionment down the track when we're looking to do something else. But if two siblings were coming to me today, I could definitely set the loan up in a way through a few different lenders that would enable them to have several, but that's probably using technology terminology now that probably won't make sense, but to have the loans independent of each other so that one is not going to restrict the other's borrowing capacity moving forward.
Yeah, and that's really important. And that's a thing that a lot of people don't get their head around. And again, you've just demonstrated in great detail the benefits of it. So I've talked to someone who really knows the ins and outs of this. Something I wouldn't mind you expanding on too, Laurie, because this is something that we constantly come up against, particularly given accountants have been on the front foot in strongly suggesting a lot of people buy properties in trusts. And as we know, this is really great asset protection with trust structures, but does have an influence on the ongoing holding costs. Can you sort of share with us a little bit of some of the things that we need to be looking out for in terms of the different types of property ownership and entities, and what impact that has on both the property lending process as well as the other impacts?
Yeah, there's a number of different ownership structures that you can have, I guess. So if you're talking, most people just buy their house in their own names and it's joined with a partner, and that's perfectly fine. Sometimes people set it up and say, I'm putting low deposit. So there's a what's called a tenants in common approach, where someone might own tenants in common, like the 60% to one party and 40% to another. And that's perfectly fine as well with most lenders. Then you start to get into trusts, where you might have, Laurie and Stephanie is trustee for the Laurie Family Trust. Those things are set up and generally pretty acceptable and don't act that much differently. All the lenders are in that space than what you would if you just bought it in a personal name. But then you get to the next level, which is a company set up. So you might have Laurie Moore Proprietary Limited as trustee for the trust. And that's a company, so it's a different entity altogether than the individual under law, common law. So you, from that point of view, you can run into some issues in terms of pricing. The banks, not every bank will lend you money in that respect. They don't play in that space, but they also generally see it as a slightly more higher risk. So they'll charge you a higher interest rate and some more fees on that side. And they'll also restrict your borrowing capacity a bit, because the negative gearing benefits, especially if you're buying an investment property, and let's be honest, that's the only way you would generally buy a property in a company with a trust, unless you were a doctor who was trying to asset protect or something bushy, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. Yeah. But if you're buying an investment property in a trust under a company name, then because it's in the company, then the company gets the benefits of the tax deductions, not the individual. And the individual, so therefore, the individual's borrowing capacity is going to fall, because the bank doesn't take into account those tax deductions when they work out their loan borrowing capacity calculations. So yeah, there's some restrictions around that. I mean, there are plenty of people who buy that, and there's a lot of the buy in that sort of structure. And certainly we get a lot of feedback from accountants, don't we, that buying in loan structures is advantageous for various reasons, but it does come with its drawbacks, and it needs to be carefully considered, because if you want to have your tax deductions properly applied to your income position, then you really want to ensure that it's in your individual names first. When you run out of those borrowing capacity deductions, or when you run out of those taxation deductions, then that might be the time to consider buying in a company and going down that path. But there are otherwise, and look, we're not accountants, so we have to be careful about what advice we give with that. And I can see Bushy go, thank God he said that. But we can certainly help with what we think is possible when you run that by your accountant. So it's also the guidance as well, because each individual is going to have a different income position. The accountant has that. If they've got an accountant who's properly savvy, they will certainly understand that and make sure that the structure is correct.
Yeah, and I think the sort of joining the dots between what you share with us there, it's important to look at the overall situation. And as you know firsthand, different types of ownership entities require different processes. The banks treat them a little bit differently in terms of their risk and potentially cost. It has an impact on capacity at times as well. So it reinforces the need to talk to someone like you who's very savvy around not just the specific finance exercises, but how that then influences and is affected by other parts of the equation, so that ultimately the borrower is making a decision considering all the facts rather than just So extremely well said there. I guess that sort of leads beautifully into something that I would like to briefly talk to you about, and that is for those that are listening to this going, gee, there's a lot more to this whole finance thing than I thought there was, and I can really see the merits in talking to someone like yourself to really get down to the nitty-gritties of what's going to be the best solution for them and their ongoing journey. What sort of key things do people need to look out for, or key questions you think borrowers need to be asking of brokers in particular to make sure they're actually getting the right person that's going to give them the best result?
Well, I think, can I start with a stat? You know, I was astounded by the other day. Well, wasn't allowed, but I think it was late last year, actually. That 22% of brokers were completely inactive over a six-month period.
Wow.
So how many brokers are there? Because I don't know the actual number.
I think it's about 70,000 something.
70,000. So over a six-month period last year, 22% of brokers did not write a single loan. It just astounded me, right? So I think that's that proliferation of the one-name band brokers that we spoke about last week, and a lot of new entrants coming into the industry and think this is easy. In my view, the barriers to entry into broking are still quite low. So you can get into it, but that doesn't make you a good broker, right? It's not an easy job. It's not. And there's a lot of experience and knowledge that goes into being a good broker. Takes experience, resilient grit, determination. You know, you've really got to enjoy getting in and going down rabbit holes and finding solutions where there might first appear not to be one. So I think, you know, that'd be the first question I'll be asking you about, you know, what experience someone's got and where they've come from. But also be trying to avoid a one-man band type of situation where someone's trying to be all things to everybody and doesn't have the support of a team around them, such as we have at Mohawk. I think I talked about this last week, but having been able to have a team where it enables me to focus and do the things well that I do well and know that someone else in the team is looking after the things that I don't do well is highly advantageous. And there's a lot of aspects to the job, but I don't think you can be fully across all of them.
Yeah, no. Extremely well said, and given that, as we've already mentioned, that bank policies and approaches are changing every week, it means that there's no set and forget in this. So if you're not on top of it and you really don't have your finger on the pulse, then an unsuspecting borrower can be missing out on opportunities that they don't even know about. So love you sharing that. The final question that's always in everyone's lips in terms of, getting out the... your crystal ball and looking at what the future holds. So what's your read on where interest rates and lending policies are heading and the impacts it's likely to have in the medium to short term?
Yeah, well, my feel is that rates have reached their peak, right? I think we're at that stage now where most economists seem to agree that that's the case, although, you know, if you start polling 100 economists and they'll come up with the same answer, they're probably wrong. So let's see if that'll go. I noticed that the Reserve Bank is keeping quite coy about it, and still talking about data supporting it and interest rate cuts and all that might be. But I just feel like, you know, we went through 18 months of rate increase. You know, the cash rate's gone from 0.1% to 4.35%, I think, is the current run. It's the biggest increase since the 1980s, I think, since the recession when you had to have. So it's been tougher than most people. If they'd been only taken mortgages out over the last 10 years, they've never experienced it.
No.
Well, a fairly tumultuous time in terms of people can use that. But the good news is I think we've reached the peak. We'll certainly see some cuts come, I think, later this year. It's just a matter of when. Yep. It could be mid-year. It could be towards the end of the year. It just depends on where the data supports that. I mean, I think the lenders have their own mortgage cliff to some degree. We'll talk about the mortgage cliff and for all these customers coming off fixed rates. We had a lot of those, didn't we? We had people getting in 1.89s and 1.99% interest rates fixed in for 2 or 3 years, and all of those have either come to an end or will come to an end soon. So that was the interest rate cliff as far as individuals are concerned. But the banks all had that too, because during COVID, they were all getting free money from the government, basically 0%, and adding their margins to that, which is where the 2% rate come from, basically.
Yeah.
Zero. So cost of funds plus 2% margin. So they'll all come out at the end of that because they're all rolling that all over onto normal rates. So what I'm seeing in the market as a result of that is that they're currently in margin management mode, most of the banks. So they're not really offering, they're not steeply discounting as much as what they were even 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, and because of that disappearance of the cashbacks that we talked about before as well, there's less incentive for people to refinance, and the banks are aware of this. So they are. So if you came to me today as an existing client and they said, and you said, look, Laurie, I'm paying 6.5%. What can you do? And I'd say, well, let me talk to your bank. And I would go, I would know the best rate that I would be able to get would be around 6%. Yeah. So I'll go to the bank and I would say, Bushy's got to leave. You give him 6.5%, and you know, I've got to refinance him to this bank and they're going to offer him 6%. I'll come in and they'll offer 6.15, something like that. They'll go, okay, well, we know that there's a cost of refinance and we're probably going to retain him if we don't squeeze our margin too much. So they're sort of playing that sort of game and I'll see that come along. I do think that'll change though, mate. I think they're in business to write loans.
Yeah.
And that's how they make their money through their growth and their mortgage book. So well, the competition will come in, and I think that'll be around about the time when the rates start to reduce.
Yep.
At the moment, they're doing it through policy tweaks here and there. They're changing little bits of policy here and there just to try and eke out a little bit of extra capacity for people. And I think the other thing that's going to change things is that this 3% buffer that we've got, where if you're at 6% and it goes to, you've got to afford it at 9%, that only came in because interest rates were expected to increase by so much, right? It's not 2%. I think it'll go down. It's only a matter of time. And I think it might be in time when the Reserve Bank puts their first cut in place was when APRA will come out and announce that the 3% buffer is no longer relevant because we're now in a downward interest rate cycle rather than an upward interest rate cycle. So I can see that changing and that impacting on the ability of people to move from lender to lender, but also to take on more debt if that's what they are choosing to do in terms of buying more properties. But I think the other thing that's happening is there's the supply side still recovering, right? So there's still a shortage, real shortage of properties. You know, everyone's probably heard stuff that's been going on with builders, a lot of builders under pressure and insolvencies and, you know, lots of supply side problems in terms of labor. There's a lot of labor working on infrastructure projects instead of on houses.
Yeah.
There's still increased demand for limited resources in terms of that are required to build houses. So you bring all that together and there's not a lot of new houses getting built. So there's a lot more competition amongst the existing stock of houses, which is putting pressure on property prices. So I can't really see that property prices are going to go down. I can only see them continue to go up, coupled with the fact that the net migration level is just so high. I never remember the numbers around this, but it was 500,000 people or something in the city the side of Canberra that came in last year or over the last 2 years. So it's crazy, crazy numbers. So they've all got to live somewhere. So it puts upward pressure on property prices. You know, but on the negative side, you know, you've got all that geopolitical stuff that's going on, that will really. So who knows whether we're headed for World War III, mate. I know it'll be doom and gloom about that. But, God, there's stuff going on in Ukraine and the Middle East and Taiwan and all that. I don't know how that's all going to play out. But yeah. And besides that, from a local point of view, we've got an election in the States this year. So Trump might be back in. Who knows what that might bring and what sort of world we might live in after that. But Australia's got another election next year as well. So no doubt there'll be some promises that will be coming through. That should be about the time when interest rate environment is starting to improve and the lenders are back on board, as I'll talk about before, in terms of, you know, an increased level of competition. So let's see what each of the parties can come up in terms of supporting the property industry further. I know that, you know, you think about the home guarantee scheme, that's been huge for first-time buyers in terms of basically the government acting as your guarantor for a property purchase, and there's 30,000 people a year allowed on access to that now. The property price levels are probably just a little bit low, so I could probably see those being increased a bit to enable more people to get access in it, because it helps in terms of the amount of deposit that people need coming in to get their first home. And of course, you know, if people are buying their first home, well, that means they're buying someone else's home, and moves up the property chain in terms of value and just has more upward pressure on property prices. So if you're thinking about buying investment property, I think, you know, now is definitely a good time.
Absolutely. And you know, sort of putting a circle around that, some pretty positive indicators of where things are heading in that regard. You know, the old demand-supply equation, very limited supply, very strong demand, improving lending conditions moving forward. So it's painting a pretty positive exercise. It's certainly indicating that, you know, if anyone's got an interest and they see an opportunity this year and they want to either buy a home or get into an investment property, then they certainly need to be talking to you sooner rather than later, Laurie. So, let's jump into the old infamous ambush round where I give you the blindfold and the cigarette and I ask you the quick questions that we ask of everyone. To kick straight into that, mate, what's your favourite quote and why?
Well, Bush, it's an interesting one, this one, because you could, there's so many that come and go in you, but there was a couple I thought about, but in the end, I went for a bit of Monty Python.
Oh, excellent.
The life of Brian, mate, and always look on the bright side of life. I mean, if you can imagine Brian up there on the cross, you know, drawing his terminal breath as he talks about at the time, and he's still looking on the bright side. So I love that. It's just a reminder not to take yourself too seriously.
Beautifully said, mate, and a great memory there from me, and very appropriate. On the literary side of the equation, Laurie, what's the top book that you recommend we read and why?
Well, if you know me well enough, Bushin, to know that I'm not into self-help books at all, which would not life be. I think about mindfulness and I immediately fall asleep. So I'm not into the self-help stuff. So, but I do love a good novel. And the problem with novels for me is that it takes me a while to get through them because I'll get through 10 pages and I'll fall asleep. It's probably starting to show my age a little bit there. But, you know, there are times, but it's hard to find a good break-in time, isn't it, where you can sit through and read a whole book, which I know my wife Stephanie does, but it's not something that I've mastered over time. But I thought I'd go Orwellian, if I can, Bushy.
Oh, yeah.
To 1984. That was an old book. It's probably about 10 years since I read it, but it was a bit of a hard slog. And the reason I chose it is it sort of prophesizes a society controlled by fear of lies. So I think it's really got some relevance in 2024, given the various dictatorships that we're currently influencing the world view and, you know, our recent experience with COVID. You know, it was driven by fear, a lot of that stuff. And besides that, I'm a big fan of The Hunger Games, and that was Orwellian as well in its own way. So there you go. There's a book. Get into it. If you really want to fall asleep, probably don't read that book.
Love it, mate. some great shares there, mate. Where I always like to finish these is getting you to share a personal happy habit or rewarding ritual or daily discipline that you think that you've employed over the time that's contributed most to your success. What would that be?
Well, they kind of go over the years, don't they? But one motto I've always sort of stood by that has stayed with me is about never leaving till tomorrow what you can do today.
Yeah.
Basically, some of those times where I get to 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I've got three things to get through. And I know that if I get them done, it's going to mean that tomorrow is going to be a brighter day and it's going to be much less pressure on. So I will always get myself to get it done because otherwise it's a shit show the next day, right?
Absolutely. And you might think, oh, well, it's not going to take me long tomorrow, but it always does. And you always get 1,000 interruptions. So taking that bit of time to get it off the table when you can, it certainly gives you a clean slate to start the next day with some confidence, mate. So that's a timeless classic. Mate, really enjoyed the chat. If you were to sort of put a bow around this, what are the key takeaways that you think we need to take from the conversation, particularly from a homeowner or refinance or property borrower perspective?
Yep, well, I think it's engage an experienced and knowledgeable mortgage broker. Don't be afraid to do that. They can help you on your property journey. Look for a broker that's part of a tight-knit team. Try and steer away from the one-man bands, or those that have only been in the industry for a very short period. Yeah. Never trust your bank because they're going to look after their best interests and not yours. I'm paid to look after your best interests. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Banks are only interested in profits, really.
Yeah.
If you don't ask, you don't get. Regularly review your loans. or better still, get me to do it for you, or your mortgage broker to do it for you. And otherwise, it'd be about loan structure. You know, loan structure is important. Yeah. To ensure your best interests are considered and maximized, really. And lowest interest rate doesn't always equal lowest cost. There are alternative lenders. There's solutions that you probably haven't thought about. Don't do co-security, as we talked about. Make sure you've got buffers in place and safety nets. Safety nets? Did I say safety nests?
You know,
make sure you've considered those and got them all in place and engage a professional that can talk you through that, who's done it thousands of times and can help you on your journey.
Beautifully said, mate. Wrap it up very neatly. There's a lot of gold in what you shared with us, mate. So for those that are listening and really resonating with what you're sharing, how can they find out more and get more involved with you, mate?
Well, look, we've got all the socials, mate. So I'm sure we share all the website details, some personal details. But yes, so you can. I'm happy for you to drop me a line. Should I share my email address, Bushy?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yep. So my email address is Laurie, which is LAWRIE @ KnowHow Property. So that's KNOWHOW Property, KnowHow Property. .com.au. So you can happy for anyone to email me directly for that. We can hook up over the phone, over Zoom, Teams, whatever works. So we'll meet face to face if you're in the same location, or we'll be in the same location soon. So all that stuff, mate.
Well, mate, really appreciate it. I feel like we've only really just scratched the surface of the wealth of wisdom that you bring to the table in this area, Laurie. And before we go, for those that are listening in and are really enjoying the conversation, make sure if you've got any other questions that you want to ask of Laurie or other team members and other experts in the area, make sure you jump onto the Property Hub Collective Interactive Facebook community, where we all get to share with other like-minded, hardworking Aussies in a very safe environment without any fear of ever being sold to. So just jump onto Facebook. Or click on the link in the show notes, and we look forward to continuing the conversation there. And finally, before we go, I just want to ask a big favour of everyone watching and listening today. That's only going to take a couple of seconds, because about 71% of you that watch and listen to the Property Hub podcast don't subscribe. So if you've ever enjoyed our shows and videos, I'd really like to ask you a big favour. And that's to hit the subscribe button, because it helps our channel more than you know. And I promise you that the more subscribers we get, the bigger the channel's going to get, the bigger the best are going to get, and the better the content's going to get for you to help you moving forward. So thanks again for your time, Laurie. You've given us some great food for thought. And as always, we need to remember to get invested. So thanks, Laurie.
Thanks, Bush. See you, mate.
Thanks for tuning in to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel. Your home for property investment insights and inspiration. And don't leave yet until you've taken the next step towards living by design. By getting my award-winning book, Get Invested, absolutely free when you sign up at knowhowproperty.com.au or bushymartin.com.au. And finally, make sure you subscribe to Property Hub to get your weekly dose of Get Invested inspiration, along with every episode of Realty Talk, Australia's leading property show for red-hot property investing news and insights, direct from industry leaders and influencers. Remember to always get invested in your knowledge, and I look forward to seeing you next time.